Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by MJ Cordova, founder and CEO of Map to Sales. Welcome, MJ.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted that you're here. We have met several times around town at various networking events and had some great conversations. In fact, the first time, I'm just remembering, the very first time we met, you and I were, I think, the only two guys at an all-women's networking happy hour.
That is correct.
What brought you there? Let's start with that. What brought you out to the quarterly happy hour?
It was a business associate that just said, hey, I'm going to this great networking event and I'd love for you to join me. And I said, sure. And hopped in the car and we went over there and I showed up and realized that you were the only other male in the group.
Well, it's for women and it's friendly to men as well. And it's a wonderful event put on by Dina Strakes Patton, the quarterly happy hour. It's connected, of course, with Girls Rule Foundation, which is a wonderful nonprofit. But you and I had a conversation there. And then we've met several other times over the years. That was a couple years ago. MJ, what I appreciate about you and why I really wanted you to join us on the show today is that not only are you an expert in sales, which is something that many small businesses, solopreneurs, and even larger SMBs are needing support with. It's the lifeblood of business, but you're also deeply human and you have some fascinating insights into the human side, both of your own work, your own life, as well as what people in these businesses are struggling with. But before we dive too deep into that, why don't you set this up with some context? What is Map to Sales and what kind of work do you do? How do you serve folks?
So Map to Sales is a subscription-based website. And so members can log in at their leisure. And there are, at this point, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 hours worth of different types of sales training, sales skill training. They're broken up for the most part into relatively short videos, so it's really easy to consume. They're probably 3 to 8 minutes long. You can choose a subject or a subject sort of line of subject go across to say, you know, I want more information about prospecting or I want more information about a needs analysis. And just kind of watch those as you will to get a little bit better. And the whole goal behind it is really my goal is to help people double sales. And there's a little bit of magic. There's a little bit of mental work you need to do. And then there's a lot of skill work. And I think traditionally why I'm so passionate about this is in many cases, the small businesses I work with are tradespeople. Could be a real estate agent and mortgage. I do a lot in those industries now too. But what happens is people don't have traditional sales training going into most of the industries I work with.
Right. They have their professional skill set. They're very good at what they do, but they haven't been taught how to talk about what they do and other dimensions of the sales process.
Exactly. And so where I back up in all of this is, number one, I've read hundreds of books. I've gone to countless seminars trying to get better at sales. And the farther down that process I went, the more I realized that what we're really doing is we're just trying to understand how human beings make decisions. And, you know, I kind of joke about it, but it's not really a joke. And all of us in our lifetimes are going to have to negotiate. All of us in our lifetimes are going to have to want somebody to make a decision. That could be in a dating scenario. That could be trying to get your kids to eat their vegetables. Life is full of trying to influence others. And the more successful we are at that, the richer our relationships become professionally, personally. So I really sort of got away from the old school, how do you answer that objection, feel found, to understanding how people make decisions and understanding how I can help someone to make a mutually beneficial decision.
You know, you're speaking about something which I firmly believe is at the heart of everything, and that is that the best salespeople, the best communicators, the best networkers, the best mentors all have something in common, which is also not taught, in school, and that is emotional intelligence, empathy, the ability to interact with people and understand that in those interactions, there are different points of view and there are different stakes and different wants and needs implicitly. That's always there. I think the worst salespeople that I've encountered are always the ones that are following a script, trying to get some leverage and sort of win in this zero-sum game. The best ones have always found a way to learn more about what I want and see if they can provide it. In other words, coming from service. You must see the good, bad, and the ugly in all of this. What's your assessment of the different places people are on that progression from, you know, butchering a conversation to a really elegant service-based conversation?
Well, some of it is affected by industry, and that's why certain industries I choose that I'd rather not work with. Short sales cycle stuff that is just kind of by nature pushy. I truly believe that, number one, if you want to be wealthy, and wealth and success mean something very different to me, because I will sacrifice a certain amount of income to feel good, to understand that what I have is important in somebody's life that can help them. And I really truly believe, one, I have something that's valuable and helps people, then all I have to really do is assist them in seeing how that helps them. My monetary gain will come. My karma gain will be immediate, because I really would rather turn down a sale than take somebody's money who I really thought didn't need something. And that takes a little bit of professional maturity to get to that point. But I really... that's why so much of my program is mental, and it's more about who are you. One of the things that I think is very, very different about interacting with me in my program is that one of the, as a matter of fact, it's a chapter in my book, which is everyone is not your customer. For most of us, the vast majority of us, if we added anywhere from 60 to a couple of hundred customers a year, would be crushing it. Now, you know, if you're in a low margin item,
sure, you need the volume,
that
you need
changes,
the scale.
But for most of us, 60 to 200 new clients in a year really is all you need to add a huge gain. That's not that hard to do. And the challenge that I have in a lot of cases is people say, well, my market is 6 million people in Phoenix. Well, if you try to please everyone, you're not going to please anyone. And so a lot of it is just really preparing mentally for understanding what your identification is, what your unique value is. And that's a buzzword that gets thrown around all the time. What's your unique value proposition? Well, I deliver expert experience. So do 80% of the other people in your field.
Right. So I heard a number of years ago somebody saying that all of your communication in marketing and in sales needs to pass the, well, I should hope so, test.
Exactly.
So many people are using as kind of their expression of their brand, like things like, well, we're honest. Well, I should hope so. You know, if the response to any of those things is, well, I should hope so, that's not unique. That's not compelling. That's table stakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of my, probably more than half of what I work with people on is just understanding who you are. And my goal is that we attract people who are like you. And that's not 6 million people in Phoenix.
No,
that's
not.
That's a handful.
You know, just riffing on this concept for a second, thinking back to a conversation we had in the studio last week, Roger Herney from Off Madison Ave, one of the large integrated marketing agencies, PR, but also has a real tech side to it, was talking a lot about personalization in marketing specifically, and how we're essentially heading towards more and more and more narrow definitions of who our cohorts or our ideal audiences are. And of course, if you play that out in the direction that it's going, I think we're ending up with meaningful audiences of one plus one plus one. So if you're a 45-year-old Hispanic female who is on the southeast corner of a particular intersection, and your phone serves you a coupon in that moment for the place right behind you, then it is in fact meeting a need that you have. And it already knows that you like, you know, whatever. And maybe you didn't know that that place was there. Salespeople, in a way, almost have an advantage because you're not, to the extent anyway that the sales process is direct and involves communicating one-to-one, whether remotely or in person, you're actually engaging with a person in that decision-making process. You don't have to do it at a distance with spooky tech and AI-driven algorithms and things. You get to find out if you're paying attention and if you're interested in learning who is this human being. You're able to discern in that conversation whether they are a potential customer or not. Not in the typical way of qualifying questions that are very one-sided, but really trying to find a match for somebody's needs and desires and the way that you can help them. Is that the kind of market psychology that you're dealing with at some level?
Yes. And you know, all this gets muddied because what technology has brought us is this overwhelming number. And so what I fight sometimes is I have their social media person saying, well, I can bring you 500 leads a month. And then on the other hand, I'm saying, look, all we really need is 50.
Right. And by the way, those 500 aren't all leads.
Right.
They're,
some of them are time wasters.
Yes.
And so, but the gross numbers are so impressive that people think, well, if I just get 10% of that, well, you know, how much energy are you spending on the 90% that you're not going to get? And why don't we just come up with a message that maybe we only get 50 leads, but those are 50 people who know us, who like us, who want to learn more about us, who are impressed by us. That's a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah, I've often said the people, so know, like, and trust is a kind of, you know, the old saw in this, but I've often said that it's, again, we're looking at it from our own point of view as if that's the most important perspective, and it's not. The people who are going to like us are the ones that feel like we know them.
Yes.
And the people who are going to trust us are the ones that feel like we're putting their needs and desires above our own. So sure, get known. But if you want to get liked and trusted, you've got to have it be very customer-centric,
yes,
very client-centric.
Absolutely.
Because that's the only way that those things ever happen. We've all got BS detectors, and we all know when somebody's out for their own self-interest.
Well, and it's almost, the BS detectors are almost beyond detection and into protection.
Mm.
Because we're so overwhelmed with marketing, and we're so overwhelmed with advertising, we're so overwhelmed with outrageous claims that we're building extra walls now. And so that's why I say that the whole key to this is understanding how to attract.
Right.
My goal for my clients is, let's not worry about chasing. Let's start attracting. Because I understand that no matter what I do, there's going to be people who love me, and there's going to be people who don't. And I know that the people who love me are going to start to form a demographic, whatever that is, male, female, 58-year-olds, 27-year-olds. It will come to light. Those people will generally associate with people who are also male or female, 28, love motorcycles, love golf, whatever that demographic is. So what ends up happening is when I focus on being the best I can be and helping that demographic that's attracted to me, they start introducing me to other people who are very much like them. Because most likely a 58-year-old woman who rides horses for a hobby isn't going to associate with a 27-year-old man who rides motorcycles for a hobby. It could happen, but most likely not.
Yeah.
So
horses and motorcycles tend to go different places.
Exactly.
Right.
So when I begin to attract one of those demographics, that my natural referral market is going to be similar to what was attracted to me to begin with.
I want to come back to this in a few minutes and talk more about specifically how you sell sales improvement, because I think that's always a fascinating conversation, a little bit meta. But before we do that, I'd love you to talk a little bit more about how you got to this point. You've been in sales for decades. You've worked across many different industries. You've got a wealth of experience and insight that comes out of seeing things working well and things not working well at all. And at what point did you realize that this current form of the way you wanted to serve would be the one you wanted to pursue. When did you start building Map to Sales and this online curriculum and then delivering the kinds of in-person work, which I'd love you to specify a little bit more about how that plays out. But what got you to this point? Let's start there.
So we'll rewind. We'll rewind a long, long, long time ago. And I'll give you my personal story, which is I grew up in a very poor area of Denver. And I was raised by a single mother. And it's a joke, but it's not a joke because I have lots of jokes, but that aren't jokes. Which was, there was a saying, don't get anybody pregnant. Don't get arrested. When you're 16, 17 years old, you can drop out of school and find a trade and live, you know, live the American dream. And there's nothing wrong with that. Tradespeople are awesome. But I went to school and I took this marketing class and they helped me get a job, which was not a burger place. So I was happy about that. And it was doing phone sales. And I started to do really well. And so I'm 17, 16, 17 years old, and I'm making probably $8 an hour at a time. Minimum wage is like $3 an hour. Yeah. And I was so impressed by the fact that if I do this good, I get to make more money. And I always thought, you know, I just want to be in sales the rest of my life. So went through college and started getting some entry-level type sales jobs. And what ended up happening was I was pretty good at them because, you know, if you communicate well, you're okay at sales. And at one point, I got a job with a Fortune 500 company who sent me through a formal training process. It was the first time I had been through it. And I thought, wow, I'm just like amazed at all the money I left on the table because I haven't been doing this right. I've just been winging it. Absolutely crushed it at that company. Broke sales records, became a sales manager. My team immediately started crushing it. And they asked me to help develop a training program. And I just mentally, it was so cool. I loved it. So I wrapped my head around that, developed a training program, continued to do well at that company, got recruited away to a smaller company that wanted me to help them turn around and develop and implement a sales program. And they would give me a portion of what they sold the company for. So I did that. And again, I went from, the numbers don't really matter, but it was about $4 million a year in advertising sales with 25 sales reps, and we did about $3.8 million with 12 sales reps. So I did exactly what they wanted me to do, turn them from red to black. Salespeople were happy, they were making more money. And it was sort of proof of concept that, you know, I have something here. Salespeople loved the training. I think one of the things that, and I think Einstein said it, you know, if you really want to master something, you can explain it very simply. And so I think that's one of the advantages of my success has been that it makes sense to people. It's not, wow, you know, this guy, what does he know? This will never work. At that point, I bought a couple of small businesses, grew those, loved it. I bought them to flip them, sold those, and took a position with a company training people how to sell. And there were some restrictions on that. And so I thought to myself, you know, I think it's time that I'm just going to do this my way. I think that if it's affordable and it makes sense to people, they can take advantage of this and they can grow their sales. And if I, you know, impact enough people, then word will get out and I can do something that I love to do, which is help people grow and help them understand there's a better way to do this and also support myself doing it. So that's kind of how we got from some A to Z in a really quick story. But, I do love the help portion of it. I mean, I could get a job today, probably make double what I make and have to go back to the corporate end of it and have more rules and stuff. And that sort of help quotient gets diluted once you run things through corporate environments. So mine is really focused on helping individuals and small businesses to just do something a little bit better.
You talked in that journey about a number of different positions that people may find themselves in. One is, you know, being on a sales team for a larger organization. One is the sales manager role, which is very different at some level than being the person on the phone or being the outside sales rep going around. And then the sales trainer role, who's coming in at some level to try to develop people and their process. And then the independent sales professional who is now outside of the system at some level, and then trying to serve probably a different slice of the business pie, one that might not be traditionally served by any of those other functions. How would you characterize those different categories, the sales rep, the sales boss or sales manager, the sales trainer, and then a kind of combination, the jack of all trades that you are now as an independent sales professional running your own operation and building your own brand in the process of doing that? What's the same and what's different?
Well, the advantage I had in a sales management position or in a trainer position was that they were employees. And so for lack of a better term, I could force them to do things. I could force them to develop good habits. In the training role, it was kind of the same way because I would work with their managers and sort of force them to do things. And then once the habits were created, sort of after the fact, light bulb went on and they were thankful. The challenge was there was things that I wanted to present, like the mental portion of it. Having people take a little bit more holistic view of how sales works. And that's less popular when you're trying to work for a corporation who's focused on here's the script and here's the process.
Why do you think that is?
I just think that it takes a relatively unique executive team to say, we're going to develop people to be better people. If my company, I have the advantage and the blessing to work with my son and some people he knows, and they do all my back-end work and website stuff. They have a very holistic view of how business should be and how human beings should treat each other. I just think that most corporations are more focused on, what is going to directly cause greater sales? And there's sort of this philosophical debate of, well, hey, the kooky guy MJ wants to have people do declarations every morning. And there's five other VPs that go, shouldn't they be making phone calls? Why would we waste time having people work on their brain? And that's just my unique thought. And I just believe there's a concept that is, again, it's in my book that I start every morning off with and I have for years. And it's erase, educate, and motivate. So I take about 30 minutes to an hour every single morning, 365 days a year, to erase my whiteboard of life. And what I mean by that is, if you picture a whiteboard on your wall and you start writing stuff on it, mortgage, car payment, put gas, change the oil, buy new tires, take the kids to soccer practice, parent-teacher conference, answer 15 emails, this whiteboard of life gets really messy and it gets really full fast. And that's not necessarily the important stuff. So what ends up happening is we put all the non-important stuff on the whiteboard of life, and then we have all these little tiny cracks we start to fill in afterward. The kids are going to get picked up from soccer practice, whether we put it on the whiteboard or not. Trust me, you will figure it out. Taking time to get your mind right will not get on the whiteboard unless you intentionally put it there. And so the first thing I do is I do about 15 minutes or so of gratitudes. So that's how I race the whiteboard of life, is I just say, here's everything in my life that's grateful for. And it sounds like a really simple, easy process until you try to do it for 5 minutes. I do it for 15. So I would challenge everyone out there, just after you listen to this, close your eyes for 5 minutes and try and fill 5 minutes with gratitudes and understand how difficult that is until you really start reaching about, I'm glad for the sunshine, I'm glad for the rain, I'm glad for... After I do that, then what I do is I intentionally read or consume some sort of information that will allow me to be more knowledgeable about life, about business, about my business, about how to serve others. And then I do something that's motivational. So for me, that's declarations. Again, I'll do declarations for 5 to 10 minutes, which sounds really simple until you go, I am successful, I am healthy. And you go, oh, it was 8 seconds. And you try and fill the rest of that time. And so this mental exercise just gets you prepared to deal with the reality of life and put you in the right frame of mind, which is focused on what you're grateful for, smarter than you were, and motivated to be the best that you can be that day. That's a hard sell to people. Even now I get pushback in the first couple weeks of my program because people are like, well, this is stupid. I don't want to stand in the mirror and say that I'm successful. And I have to say, just trust the process because in 20 days you're going to feel differently.
Yeah. I'm reminded of, you know, childhood watching the very first Karate Kid movie with the wax on, wax off, where, you know, this is stupid. I want to learn karate. I want to learn how to defend myself against these bullies. At what the point when Mr. Miyagi finally says, okay, look, do the things I've been telling you to practice, you know, paint the fence, sand the floor, wax on, wax off. And he realizes he's been learning basic moves that translate into the other things. I'm astounded by the fact that even in 2019, there's still so much confusion about the source of high performance. We've got how many decades, even century of athletes and engineers and inventors talking about some of their personal rituals and some of the ways in which they've developed themselves, you know, and the fact that large organizations in particular, but small businesses and solopreneurs as well, completely thinking that, well, if I just ignore all of that stuff, well, those folks, you know, that's cute if you're Jerry Rice or somebody who's, you know, really taken your performance to next level in your era. Obviously, I'm dating myself here. But, you know, what we need to do is have people repeating these scripts and picking up the phone, smile and dial, and just get out there and drive results. Why is there such a confusion about the source of results?
I don't think, which kind of goes back to some of what we deal with in this program, I don't think people see themselves as Jerry Rice. People say I'm crazy sometimes. A lot of people dislike me for it, but I will tell you, I believe with all ounces of my being, I am the best at what I do. My results will end up where they will, but I truly believe I'm the best at what I do. And, you know, Grant Cardone has a lot more money than I do, and I don't believe his sales training is better than mine. I think Grant Cardone made some decisions a decade ago that changed the course of his finances, but I don't think his training is better. What I'm really getting at is people don't believe that they can be as good as they can be. They sort of get wrapped up in this, well, if I could just make six figures, or if I could just do this, if I could just do that. Our problem is not that we dream too big. Our problem is that we settle for too little. And that doesn't mean all of us are going to be billionaires. But just the journey of trying to be the billionaire, just the journey of trying to be the best version of ourselves is going to make our lives so much more fulfilled. And that's one of the messages that I like to give is just close your eyes and imagine for a moment what the best version of you would be. Would you be healthier? Would you be in love? Would you take more vacations? And the answer to all of those is it's possible. But it's not going to happen with the programming that's currently in your brain.
Right. And this is where I think there's another source of confusion or delusion, perhaps, where people think that the dreaming and the mindset stuff is sufficient to accomplish the goals. And of course, the reality is that the dreaming, the mindset work, the reprogramming could simply orient your actions, and it's the actions that are important. But without that context shift, you won't take any different actions because you will, as you said so nicely, have settled for too little. I think this process of settling and getting ourselves unsettled, we're going off into the philosophical weeds here just a little bit, but I love this stuff as well. I think it's important to get ourselves unsettled, to actually realize that our comfort and complacency and complaining, I'm writing this on the spot here, this is coming out very nicely, I'm glad we're recording this, our comfort, our complacency, and our complaints are keeping us where we are, and we're okay with it. We love to say we're not, but well, we are.
We have to remember that there's, you know, they're your reptile brain and all that stuff. And I just like to boil stuff down to dummies like me. here's the reality is this. Your brain's primary function is to make sure that you reproduce, that you eat, and that you're safe.
And you're not eaten, right. Okay. You eat and you're not eaten.
So part of being safe is your brain wanting to keep you in a place that is predictable. So you may make crap money. You may hate your boyfriend or your girlfriend, but you're going to stay making crap money and you're going to stay with your boyfriend or girlfriend in most cases because your brain says, wait. I know it's not perfect, but it's predictable. And if we break up, what if we never get another girlfriend? What if the next one's worse? And so it says, we're just going to do what we've always done. We're going to follow the same map, right? That's how this all started with map to sales. We're going to follow the same map. Your brain is going to follow the map that it knows. And until you change the map, the results will always be similar to the results you've always had. And you can't change that map without telling your brain, we have to go to a different destination. Now, if we're going to change the destination, why would we change it a little bit? Why wouldn't we change it a lot, all the way? And I like to explain it that your brain, again, we can go into the weeds about reticular activating systems and all this stuff that nobody cares about. The reality of it is, in a simple explanation, your brain's like Google. If you tell your brain, go find me success. Your brain starts thinking differently than it would if you said, brain, just try to help me not fail. Your brain will work in two completely different ways. And so the reality of it is, once I tell my brain every morning, find me success, my brain will find a way to do it. It'd be different for me than it is for you because our brains are differently. And that's why I don't like cookie cutter systems. Now, I have a process because that process helps understand how the brain works and make decisions and assist me into doing that. But your process that we work on would be very different than somebody else's because they're different, their brain is different, their product is different, their market is different, who they attract is different. We can do all that, but we have to make sure that we're in that right mindset to attract who we want to attract.
You know, the map is not just a metaphor. It's a guide, and it also helps orient your customers through the training you're providing them. But let's talk about literal maps for a second. Before we came in here to the studio, you were telling me you've been on the road a lot recently. You've been going out into what in a large urban area we might consider the hinterland.
Yes.
Going to some more remote locations and working with businesses in outlying areas in other states. And you have some unique insight about, first of all, why that is a good idea. And second of all, what's different out there from a business and sales point of view. Share with us a little bit how you came to, first of all, the realization that you needed to take this on the road, literally. And then what you're seeing out there in Main Street, smaller Main Streets around the Southwest.
Well, what I do now, because it's the subscription-based website, doesn't take a lot of my personal time. And so I call out, I reach out, you know, maybe message people, email people. Well, I think at some point, you know, the players in a certain area just get tired of hearing, and they would have either made the decision or not. And so I thought, well, what can I do? And a referral led me to a small town in Utah, and that small town in Utah led me to multiple other business owners and working with them. And I think that because they don't hear the noise of the big city, I think that they're a little more open to just saying, okay, you know, I'll at least listen to you. And if I can get somebody to listen to me for a little while, usually I can make sense to them. And so there's been a lot of interest in these sort of, they're towns of anywhere from probably 10 to 20,000, which, you know, from Phoenix area seems relatively small. But when you get there, I mean, there's still hundreds of businesses and hundreds of business owners. And I think there's a decent size need because, again, these are people who probably grew up in the town and decided they were going to be an insurance agent or open a business of one type or the other and you know, sort of were a good person and the community supported it and don't understand that, you know, there's some things they can do to make things maybe easier or grow a little bit more.
Kind of like that time in your own personal history when you were first exposed to some high quality formalized sales training. You thought, oh man, I've been doing it wrong. There's more to this. I've had some success based on charisma and communication skills, but with some better concepts and some better practices, I could take this to the next level. Is that yes. what you're finding there?
And I think part of it, even in Phoenix, it's just culture sort of dictates humility sometimes. And I think when you're in a bigger city and maybe you're not as down-honed and humble as some of these smaller towns, but one of the distinctions that I make is most companies, and you know, if I let's talk about the insurance industry, because I was in that industry and with a couple different companies, they teach you how to sell their product. Here's how to sell our product. They don't teach you how people buy things. There's a huge distinction because what ends up happening is you, and I don't think it's intentional, but or made in malice, but it's a relatively manipulative process as opposed to just understanding how Adrian buys something and helping you to make that decision if what I have to offer is going to help you and fulfill some sort of need or make your life better and somehow or protect you or whatever that service or product is. And I think once that flips and you understand how people buy things, the world's your oyster at that point. I mean, you really can influence just about any decision you need to, provided that, you know, it really is helping that person.
You also probably get a greater insight into and clarity into who you really do need to be talking to. Once you realize that people buy differently and that some people, even if they need what you sell, are never going to buy it, you can be okay with that and still come from a place of service and compassion and understanding and also quickly identify them and move on. It's just shifting from how to sell this thing to how somebody buys this thing is not just a small shift. It's really quite significant in terms of—
It's huge.
It changes the entire game. It's not the same sport.
Exactly. And one of the reasons I did extremely well selling life insurance and actually liked it was because of that shift. And you would talk to insurance people and they, you know, sell, like, I hate selling life insurance. And that industry is a great sort of microcosm of what I talk about because there's people who make insane money selling life insurance, but their focus really isn't how to sell the life insurance, which, you know, you can scare people into doing. You know, what happens if you die and your wife's going to be at home alone, she's going to lose the house. And instead of sitting down with a family and saying, here's the reality of the situation. My concern is if something did happen that you're not prepared. And let's just talk about different ways to be prepared. Because at that point, I care about the family. As opposed to, hey, let's just, you know, let's offload some life insurance because the commissions are great. The people who sell a ton of life insurance make an insane amount of money, but they get that concept that I'm not here to sell life insurance. I'm here to help you understand the financial situation you're in and what we can do to protect it.
Can you teach people to care?
I think so. If you sort of start back at that process of, number one, am I right mentally? Am I whole mentally? Am I prepared to do this? One of the biggest challenges I have is the financial pressure that people have. And so they get into sales and maybe it's a commission-based sales product. They've got to feed their family. So now there's this balance of almost a desperation versus the patience and versus the true caring nature of, if I go about this the right way, if I care and I help people, someday that's going to turn into a great living. Well, that's a challenge when the mortgage is due tomorrow.
Totally. I mean, I've said for years, not only based on my own experience, but also, you know, interacting with many other people, there's such a toxic, suppressive quality to money stress. I mean, it's the number one reason why marriages end. It's the number one reason why people, you know, I think engage in poor behavior. It's driven by, motivated by something that's kind of screwy in the way they're thinking about money and what money provides, whether from desperation or from the abuse of power and wealth. I mean, it's truly one of the most, you know, if you want to talk about biology, right? If we've got a brain wired to survive in an environment of, you know, scarce resources, there is nothing that will get a human being triggered, hooked, confused, scared, like money pressure. And then in the very moment in time when you should be taking right actions to correct that situation is when it's the hardest to do that. Because, you know, for myself, the suppression of creativity and everything, you know, I need to think my way out of a situation and I just can't because of how much stress comes from that financial pressure. I mean, it's real. This is a no joke thing. And so for sales professionals whose financial well-being is directly tied to their ability to get results, to be able to somehow set that hard wiring aside enough to be there for the other person, that's no small feat. That does take some serious amount of time in the gym, so to speak, the mental gym.
A great, great analogy.
To be able to be there in that moment, you've got to have done those reps somewhere else, or you're going to be not only desperate, you're going to be unsuccessful. Because if you're coming from desperation, it never leads to good things.
Exactly. And so, you know, some of that is the balance of the skill set stuff too, where, yeah, hey, let's work on some skill set while we build the mindset.
When did you write the book?
Last August.
And what was that like for you? I know for some folks that are engaged in more verbal professions, you might be very comfortable. I'm projecting. I have no idea. I'm happy for you to correct me or tell me what your experience was. For myself, I'm an excellent verbal communicator. I've been doing this literally since I was 5 years old because I grew up in a radio station. My family was on the radio. I've been speaking on stage since I was five. I never balk at any kind of verbal interaction. If you told me tomorrow I had to fly to Europe and walk straight off the plane to give a speech to 20,000 people and it was on a subject I'd never spoken on before, I'd be excited because it's my favorite thing in the world to do. But ask me to write something and I'm miserable and I struggle. What was your experience writing the book and really trying to take all, it may be very different from mine, I'm not presuming, but to take all of the richness that I know you deliver in nuanced ways when you're interacting with people in real life, as they say, and then put it into the book. How did that go?
I got expert advice. So I had started writing a book, which is really more of a journal than a book, but it had a lot of concepts. And I thought, you know, I can manipulate this into a book about 10 years ago. And then last year I set a goal and I said, I'm going to get this done this year, and had started actually writing in what I thought was book format and reached out to somebody who could help me do the publishing portion of it and get it put on Amazon and all that. And he said, we had a long talk and he said, look, if I needed to sell something, I would trust you. And whatever you told me to do, I would do. He says, you have the credibility. I've published books. He said, I'm asking you to trust me. And I said, sure. And he said, nobody will read your book.
Yeah. Straight talk.
And I said,
so
okay.
Valuable.
I said, okay, let's talk. And he said, well, he said, it's eloquently written. He said, this is probably going to be 600 pages. He said, I know statistically over 90% of books don't get finished. He said, in addition to that, your book is not an easy read. It's not. He said that the way your book is written, you have to read it in long segments, or you'll sort of have to go back and reread to get the context. And he said, if you truly want to help people, he said, and especially in your industry where the attention spans are short, the book has to be much shorter and it has to be written in a manner with which you would speak to people. He said, so I'm not asking you to dumb it down. What I'm asking you to do is have a conversation on paper. Mm-hmm. So we did about 4.5 hours worth of interviews that he transcribed, sent back to me, and then we moved things back and forth because things I said were he wouldn't know the context of, and we fixed all that. So my book is actually written, and people who know me well said they were just giggling when they were reading it because they said, we could actually hear your voice and the phrases that you use. So it's a very easy read. It's a relatively short book. But the things, the concepts that need to get communicated are in there. And there's, you know, stories to back them up. So the reality of it is, he said, look, if you want to write your dream book, go ahead and do it. He said, but you're writing it for you. You're not writing it for people who are going to take advice. He said, now, if you want to write 10 more of these books like we did together, he said, each of them will probably be a bestseller and you'll help people. So he's like, either way, it's your choice. And I'm like, well, clearly, one of us is a great salesman in this situation.
Well, it goes back to something, it parallels something you said a moment ago. You know, what you're thinking about and doing from the perspective of writing a book is very different than what you're thinking about and doing from the perspective of reading a book. Just like learning how to sell something and learning how people buy something.
Exactly.
It's very different, but it matches perfectly. You had to learn how people read in order to write the better book.
Yes.
As you go around and deliver your workshops, I know your primary offerings are in the online curriculum and things of that nature, but you're still finding value and going in and meeting with teams at a brokerage firm or at a small business. What kinds of concepts and skills are you able to really develop in a shorter in-person engagement? Obviously, it's supported by the online work, but what do you focus on? Where do you start? You walk in, there's a team. They've been told, hey, we're bringing in a sales trainer. He's going to help y'all. And when you walk into the room, not everybody in the room is necessarily thrilled to be there because they're also thinking, listen, I just need to be out making money today. I don't know why I have to sit through this. What's it like as you begin to build that relationship with the people in the room so that the training can actually get done?
It's honestly a big portion of a sales pitch on my part. I have to get them to buy into the concept that they need to change the way they think. Here's the hour presentation I give in that scenario is really talking about in order for us to significantly increase our performance, which I talk about doubling sales. And statistically, I know I can do that. And I have a history of doing it with individuals and companies. Three things have to happen. We have to think differently. We can't follow the same map. It's logic. If you do what you did last year, you're going to get what you got last year. We have to create different habits. Okay. If I, doesn't matter what industry I'm in, if somebody is doing exponentially more than me, they have different habits. I don't care what the industry is. I don't care if you're a computer programmer, if you're in sales, if you're a small business owner that owns a heating and air conditioning company, if somebody's doing 10 times as much as you, I promise you they have different habits. They have to. And we have to communicate differently. So the program will help you see a different map, create the habits in order to follow that map, and communicate appropriately along the way. Because people are going to speak different languages when you go to different cities, different destinations. And so that's what that meeting looks like.
You know, you just summarized very eloquently decades of research on deliberate practice and other ways of improving human performance. And it really does boil down to exactly what you said. The highest performers in your field have different habits, and they probably have had them for a long time. You know, virtuosity, I guess is the right word, is not a function of some innate genius. It's a function of more time spent doing hard things. It really is about the practice and the habits that support the kind of performance that you want. Now, this is only one thing that a small business needs. It's obviously an important thing, but when you are interacting with an owner or with their team, are you also becoming aware of other areas of their operations, their marketing, their, you know, the way they're communicating with the world that are lacking? Do you support or make referrals? How do you help them? So sales happens in a context, and part of that context is marketing. It's not the only context, but that's a big part of it. How do you assess, or do you, in fact, make recommendations about what to do in marketing and social media and things of that nature?
There are times. And what I would tell you is, and I'll go back to, I'll digress a little bit, but I think it's applicable. Sports analogies are awesome, but hopefully everybody follows. Everybody should know who Michael Jordan is. And so when we talk about the habits, Michael Jordan, arguably great talent. There's no doubt about that. But there were people who were faster. There were people who could jump higher. There were people who were taller. Michael Jordan had a great talent. Aside from that talent, he had insane habits with regard to practice, with regard to studying film. And there's a story I love to tell about him, which was, you know, when he was a little bit farther on in his career, he had already won championships. There was some rookies that came into practice, and young in theory, they should have been able to run faster and play longer because they're younger. He was in his 30s. And he was playing them one-on-one, and he would beat one, and the next one would come on, and he'd beat that one, and the next one would come on, he'd beat that one, to the point where they're dripping with sweat, their hands are on their knees, and the three of them who got to take a two-game break in between were exhausted, and he was yelling at them that they were never going to make it because they couldn't continue to play him that night. So that kind of speaks to his habits. And aside from that, Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods and Barry Bonds, all who were at one time the greatest players on the earth, game-changing, culture-changing players, all had coaches. And so where this comes back to what you were talking about is, I may not have the answer for delivery, or I may not have the answer for customer service. What I would tell them is you need to find the answer in that area. I've worked for major companies and had profitability responsibility for companies that had distribution, that had delivery, that had inventory. So I'm familiar with all of that stuff. A long time ago, I was in charge of a quality control program for a company that I worked for and learned a very in-depth process training that's used worldwide. It's used by the Japanese, which is why they kill us in the quality of their cars. And so my brain is very process-focused. So in running big companies and doing that, and then also running my own small businesses, I'm very aware of processes, and I can identify gaps in it. Some gaps I can help with. Others I would tell them to find specific coaching on. But I think that coaching and resourcing is, sometimes I think people see it as a sign of weakness that, hey, I own this business and I don't know about marketing. Hey, I own this business, I don't know about sales. Hey, I own this business and I don't know about fulfillment. And instead of humbling themselves and saying, why don't I get somebody who knows this? They almost figure, well, I'll just get better at something else. I'll compensate by doing more of this or less of that or cutting costs in this other way instead of saying, again, in my mind, every business has a soul. Every business has an identity. And one of the things that I work with people on is writing mission statements for themselves. You know, even if you work for a company, I always made my individual sales reps write a mission statement, a personal mission statement. And as a team, we always developed a team mission statement because I think that that soul and that identity is very important in sort of understanding that your business has to be healthy, right? You wouldn't play a sport with one arm. So you wouldn't say, well, I'll just get better with my right arm. You'd say, okay, how do I make my left arm strong enough to do this? And so I think people just need to sometimes just be a little more humble and say, okay, I'm not good at this. I just, and it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It just means I've never been exposed to the experiences that would make me strong in this area. So why don't I get exposed to that experience that somebody else has in an area that I'm not strong?
Yeah. The whole idea of developing your strengths and then managing around your weaknesses, or in some cases, just simply hiring or partnering with people who can do the things you're not good at. As a parting shot in this conversation, I'm curious if you could just give some insight. There's a lot of different types of folks that listen to the show. They may be a solopreneur. They may be a small business owner working on a small team. They may be an SVP or someone from the C-suite of a larger corporation. When it comes to your experience and sales improvement, really getting under the hood, I think we've gotten a really good sense of your uniqueness and really placing mindset and habits and personal development at the center of the process. What's the biggest mistake that you see people making, and what should they be doing to fix it? What's a takeaway kind of bit of guidance you can provide that at least gets them pointed in the right direction?
I think it's about process. And one of the talks I'll always have, whether it's with an individual or a large corporation, I'd love to have the talk, is about the process. Now, that process will include, how do we make you whole? How do we make your salespeople whole so that this isn't a manipulation, but a true win-win? And so I love talking process, because that process involves, how do we get people prepared mentally? That process involves, how do we understand how people buy our product? And what's the correct path to take them through that makes it easiest for them to make that decision? What are the words we use? Because I'm a big fan of scripts, not to manipulate, but to keep that conversation going in the manner that helps you make the decision, that's most comfortable for you to communicate. That's why I like scripts, is because it's really about, how do I make you comfortable? How do I communicate in a language that's comfortable for you to make this decision? And that's why I think scripts are valuable. So I love having that conversation that's the start to finish of, how do we be the best version of us, create the habits we need, and communicate in the manner that our customers are going to feel comfortable making this decision.
MJ Cordova, founder and CEO of Map to Sales. Where do people connect with you, learn more about your offerings, hire you for a workshop, or look to see whether or not this online training program would be a good fit for their people?
You can email me at mj@maptosales.com, and it's map T-O, not the letter. I mean, not the number. Maptosales.com. You're welcome to call me at 480-436-1820. And we can have a quick talk about it, or you can go to the website, which is www.maptosales.com.
Well, I just really appreciate the work you're doing, bringing the humanity and the heart and the head to the process, really trying to make people better humans so that they can be better business owners and better salespeople. And I enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.